So welcome back, and we were going to go over the same thing we went over last week because you guys are really slow and it takes a long time to get it. No, it's because the connection was so bad that barely everybody was hearing about maybe 30 or 40% of what was being said. So I apologize, and hopefully things are running better. I'm still in Texas, and we've done a lot of stuff to make sure that my internet connection here is better. So hopefully everybody can hear. And what we were going to talk about today, which we talked about last week, and hopefully there'll be a new insight into this. A friend of mine and mine, Sean Hargan, said that it takes X amount of time to learn the aqua map because there's no specified time to learn it, because the more you learn, the more you learn. And it's just like learning in general. It's like education. You never get to the point where you're completely educated. Okay, I didn't think you get to the point where you have very much a functioning ability to work with this stuff without thinking too hard. It just becomes ingrained. Just like when you're practicing music and you're practicing scales and scales and scales and scales. Finally, it just becomes second nature. And you don't have to think about them. Your mind and your body just does it automatically. And that's what happens with this map. The more we work with it, the more we apply it, the more we look at it, it shifts and gets easier. And it's, you know, and the four quadrants are so, it's basically so simple yet so profound. And those of us who've been, you know, I've been doing the integral thing for about 10 years now. We just think, oh, yeah, of course, we just kind of take it for granted. But when you look at the world and you look at policies, governmental policies, for example, concerning drug use, there are almost always uniquadrant. And things that are uniquadrant just don't have the breadth and the depth to actually, you know, function very well. And because you're missing just, and now it'll cause other things to happen, but probably not what you're looking to happen. For example, in Colorado and in Washington State, in the United States, they've legalized marijuana. And anyway, I just got a message from Pam. He says, get the login from my email. Anyway, that says class info. So hopefully everybody's got that. So, yeah, and that's a very, you know, basically a lower right attempt to do something better. Okay. And, but it doesn't include lower left, kind of the cultural, it doesn't include the interiors of people involved, it doesn't include upper right, the health causes. It's just one governmental move, and who knows what effects that will have. And until we get to the point where more of us can think in an integral way and consider all four quadrants, we're still kind of locked into the first tier merry-go-round that just really doesn't work very well. So hopefully that will begin to, you know, the more of us that look at these things, and I think it's the ineffectiveness of the old way of doing things that eventually compel people to start trying different things. Just as when people make the decision at some point to sober, to reach out for help, to say, no, I can't do this anymore. It's because there's been a lot of, I mean, really, really trying a long time to come into some kind of livable relationship with these substances, and they are not, they're not reasonable, you know, in the case of addiction. And they will take over, they will bully, they will beat, they will humiliate, they will destroy. And so you have to kind of reach that point where you're not willing to play that game anymore, and you're willing to do whatever it takes. And, you know, prior to just recently, it was very hard to know whatever it took. I mean, there was, you know, AA, and that's, of course, that's been the starting point for a modern recovery movement, But and then there out of that, I think emerged, well, kind of orange approaches, where we looked at, you know, brain chemistry and brain disease and this, that, and the other, and then kind of the green, and I'm talking in the language of spiral dynamics, the colors, the green kind of postmodern multicultural intuition that things need to be holistic. But, you know, what does that mean? Well, holistic would be interpreted, you know, differently by everyone, depending on their particular, what they know and what they don't know. And usually it's, you know, well, you know, let's eat healthy food and we've got to work the body. And, you know, it's just kind of intuition. And we're like, it's like making a stew or a soup or something with no real idea. You put a little of that, and hopefully, you know, you'll heat it up and some hours later it'll be edible and nourishing and good. But that's kind of a real sloppy holism. There's no real precision to that. So just these four quadrants breaks us out of that kind of sloppy holism or uni-quadrant approach, or maybe bi-quadrant approach in some cases, but usually a uni. And people tend to try to affect this change in the quadrants that they're more comfortable with. So if you're a legislator, you'll try to change the laws. If you're a doctor, you'll try to do an upper right physical medication type of intervention. If you're, you tend to be more spiritually inclined, you say, well, all you need is, you know, just a spiritual awakening and it'll take care of all your problems, all the issues. And, or all you need community, you need the church, you need to join the group or whatever it might be. So, that's what we tend to do, and we tend to miss a lot. And in the case of addiction, it's insidious. And one of the what are we talking about in four quadrants? Well, we're talking about just for definition's sake, we're talking about four basic dimensions that are ever present in every occasion, every situation. And you can look at anything. You can look at dragons. You can look at football teams. You can look at organizations, hamsters, whatever, using the four quadrants, and you'll find that you'll have a much more inclusive way to look at it. In this case of addiction, we're talking about addicts and addiction. And one of the characteristics of the quadrants is you can't reduce any of the other quadrants to the other quadrants. They're irreducible. And you just can't say, well, it's the same. And of course, people try to do that all the time. And so when you have reductionistic science or reductionistic psychology, as in behaviorism or B.F. Skinner's work, they say, look, there's no interiors. There's just stimulus. There's just outer stuff. It's just brain, and we can train and do whatever we want. And the interior dimension is an illusion, which is kind of weird because, I mean, the very thing that's experiencing B.F. Skinner's teaching is an interior experience. But it kind of, they try to simplify and break it down and make it less sloppy without all these, you know, these caverns and nooks and crannies and incredibly complex inner dimensions. So let's just deal with that. But again, it doesn't, you can't do that. And one of the ways I like to explain that, to say you have, you have a time machine of some sort and you're able to, hook up the brains of literary geniuses, okay, while they're in the process of creating a masterpiece. So you have Goethe writing his great work. What was it? Come on, Goethe fans out there. Anyway, read it in college. And you have Shakespeare writing, say, you know, Romeo and Juliet. And you have Hemingway writing The Sun Also Rises, et cetera. And so you hook with the different brain scans and different technology that we have, and when they're in that flow state creating and writing, you're going to see similarities. You know, different parts of the brain are firing, are turning and shutting off, or there's different relationships of the different parts going on while you're in this creative flow state. And you might say, you know, dopamine levels are this and that, and are, you know, you can measure the brain chemistry. And so you have a really, really good picture, and you see the commonalities for people who are in these creative flow states of creating a literary masterpiece. And that's really, really extraordinary, good, useful information. But that will not tell you anything about what the experience is, the inner experience of in being in one of these flow states and having this stuff come through you and creating this masterpiece of literature. To do that, you would have to ask the masters. You know, William, what's it feel like, you know, when you're writing one of these things? Herr Goethe, what does it feel like when you're Faust, by the way? And, you know, same thing, Hemingway or whoever. And then you start to have, okay, well, this is what the brain is doing, and this is what the person is experiencing. And you begin to see the commonalities in both cases. And then you have, the upper right quadrant, which is, you know, the physical brain, what it's doing. Then you have the interior phenomenological, what is the experience, what does it feel like? And you'll hear things like, well, it feels like, in some sense, that I'm being the pen. You know, or I'm being typed through, or it's channeling through me, and it's just coming through, and I'm the instrument. I'm not actually creating it. That's what these deep creative states often feel like, whether it's writing or dancing or music, whatever it might be. So that's how you can't reduce. So you can, and they're both valuable, and they're both totally valid, but what you can't one to the other, and that is what's been. Often done, and it just leads to imbalance. So when we're looking at addiction, we have to include what's going on physically in the upper right quadrant, the physical body of the individual. And also, you know, one of the things I haven't talked about a lot, but Ken does, that in the upper right quadrant is not only what's going on in the body, but the behaviors that are exhibited by the addict. And of course, it's a progressive disease, and so at different stages in the addiction, people will be exhibiting different behaviors, different mannerisms. The body will be doing different things. So, if you know, about drugs and stuff, you can pretty much tell when somebody's loaded, and pretty much tell what they're on. So, if an alcoholic stumbling around smells like a distillery, and you know, bloodshot eyes and puffy face and all that stuff. Or somebody is on, amphetamines will exhibit certain behaviors, and heroin, you know, would be the slow, lethargic, sleepy thing. Or somebody that's coming off, it's craving drugs, starting to go into withdrawals. You've seen that all too. So these are all part of the upper right quadrants, and need to be accounted for and dealt with and understood. And then, of course, the interior experience, what's going on when somebody interiorly, when they finally get the drugs, it's like, oh, the relief, the temporary relief, the buzz, the whatever it might be. And then the constant need to get more and more as the brain begins to adapt and you start to develop a tolerance as the brain tries to balance itself out in the presence of all these substances. So you have to keep, you know, using more and more to get the same bang, and it's never quite the same bang. So you're chasing that high, and there's a despair, and there's shame, and there's hatred, and there's anger, and there's projection, all this crazy stuff that's going on in the interiors. And then you look to the lower left, well, what's going on there? Well, there's, you know, it's certainly rearranging the cultural structure, right? Because when you become an addict, you really can't, you know, you really don't want to hang around with your straight friends anymore, and they probably don't want to hang around with you either, because the only thing you really care about is getting and using in the latter parts of the latter stages of the disease. So there'll be actual new cultural units formed to support the drug habit. And any of you in a classic movie about heroin addiction, Trainspotting, it's pretty cool. I mean, it's very painful and horrific in some cases. But in the beginning of the movie, you know, you're in London with these really hip, well-dressed, you know, sexy young people, and they're doing heroin. It looks like just the coolest thing ever, you know. And most of my heroin addict students see that, they start craving just when they see that particular part of the movie. And then it takes it on from there, and it begins to just descend into the lower reaches of hell, of addiction, and just gets horrifically awful. So, yeah, but you can see that the culture that has formed around drugs, and I remember that when I was experimenting with drugs when I was 13, 14, back in the 1970, 72 era, how that, you know, there was such a kind of a cultural identification with a counterculture and smoking pot and acid. It was our generation. Don't trust anybody under 30, all that. But I even noticed very quickly that it began to shift, even in my brief 2 years, and maybe and by the time I started, it was already, you know, it was already kind of going downhill. But it became much more about, you know, there was money and criminality and people ripping each other off, and it began to deteriorate, and the idealist spiritual stuff evaporated really quickly for me. And of course, I was way too young to be doing any of those things. So, so there's the cultural aspects, and of course, then there's the positive cultural aspects of needing groups of people. I mean, we are cultural beings. No man is or woman is an island. We live in community, and some of us are that's easier for, you know, those of us who are introvert or extrovert. You know, we'll have kind of a different relationship to communities. And when I was in grad school, they taught us the definitions of introversion, extroversion as kind of a linear thing. Say, you know, it's a horizontal line. And on the left-hand side, you have the total introvert. And on the right-hand side, you have along this line, this axis, you have the total extrovert. And the introvert is somebody that generally gets refilled and refueled by being alone. And the extrovert is the person who gets refueled and gets re-energized by being with people. Okay, I tend toward the introversion, even though, you know, I said one time I'm an introvert cursed with extrovert gifts, you know, so there's kind of that thing. My gifts are people, teaching, inspiring, talking, and stuff like that. Writing's a good thing for an introvert, but I'm called to go out in the world. And that doesn't mean it's bad for me. It just means it takes a little more effort. And oftentimes I'll really have a lot of breakthroughs when I actually pay attention and cultivate community, because it's not something I'm comfortable with, something I'm really going to have to work on. And my favorite Carl Jung bits of wisdom is that says that God comes through the inferior part. So if you find yourself, you know, that quadrant or that area that you're really the least comfortable with, it's probably the area where you'll find a lot of your breakthroughs and a lot of your growth. So just because you don't like it or you're not comfortable with it doesn't mean that you're not supposed to engage with it. And so with time and effort and practice, we can actually shift radically our relationship to almost anything. So, yeah, so if people can, it is appropriate for them to be a part of an AA, NA group. It's great, very recommended. Some people can't go there for various reasons. They can't wrap their heads around kind of the religious aspects of it for various reasons, and often it's because they had a very negative religious kind of upbringing, and it brings up a lot of stuff. So, but people aren't condemned in integral recovery anyway to die alone in the street because they can't go to AA meetings. We still work with them, but if they can find that kind of support group, it can be very useful. And again, we've talked about what is AA. It provides connection, it provides support, it provides inspiration, it provides kind of remembering, you know, what it's like when you were, you know, when people tell their stories, like, oh yeah, I remember that. Absolutely. So you don't, you know, and often the alcoholic voice is chipping away at your resolve, you know, it'll be different this time. Maybe you can just have a drink and stuff. And you know, that's true for some people, but I don't think that's true for the, you know, the person that has really crossed the line into addiction. That you know, and the big book says, you know, every addict, alcoholic would love to drink like a normal person, but they just can't do it because the whole craving response starts again and it begins to overpower you. So, and the community provides accountability. Very, very important. I found in early recovery with people that I work with, they know that they have to talk with me on Tuesday on Skype. They will be they go, oh man, I just won't do it. it keeps them when they're having a weak moment from actually plunging over that particular edge. So accountability is good, and support. And when we hang out with like-minded people who are working on the same things that we are, we tend to inspire each other, polish each other, push each other. You know, we learn from each other. So I couldn't imagine, like, just practicing guitar without playing with other people or listening to other people's music. It's all the stuff I absorb through other musicians and traditions and different styles that I channel through my own capacity, my own practice to create my own music. So anyway, communities are just really important. And we can see that first of all, as I mentioned, the destruction of communities because of drugs. And, you know, in the United States now, we have this tremendous problem of young people leaving Central America and trekking across Mexico to get to the United States border. And this huge migration, children's crusade of people trying to get to the United States so they can have a better life. And a lot of children coming from Honduras. And, you know, I have friends down there, and I've worked down there, and Honduras is it's a beautiful country, but it is just in the throes of this cartel criminality, and there's violence and murder, and there's no accountability, and it's a very scary place to be. So the children are looking, and that's not just people using drugs; that's just the corruption and the criminality of all that illegal blood money coming through that country, being channeled from South America and the United States, and the criminal support systems that it needs. It's just incredibly painful. So you can see how in the lower left quadrant, culturally, it destroys countries, political systems, the way people work together, definitely destroys families, relationships, friendships, and in recovery, we need to reconstruct communities and families and support groups that where we are working from a much higher level of ethical, moral development, and we're helping each other out, and we realize that we need each other, and we need the inspiration and support of other people. So that's lower left, and of course, lower right is just how can you not consider lower right? It means, are there any facilities? Is there housing? Is there food? Is there insurance? Are there treatment centers? Are there money to pay us, as therapists or coaches, psychologists, whatever our particular thing is? Do we have places for people to go and to be safe and away from drugs while they regain their strength and regain their health? And it's just a tremendous problem, and it's difficult. So and then even if the government does get involved, what kind of treatment will the government sponsor? And I know that there's certain treatment centers that they're to get in certain states to get government funding, you have to do A, B, C, D, E, F, which is probably a good idea. However, they become factories that are more focused on fulfilling A, B, C, D, and E, and F than they're actually helping the individual and their family. So anyway, there's a real complexity and real problems here. And then again, to overcome, to look at that, you need to include all four quadrants, both the interiors and the exteriors, because if you try to do just focus on interiors, just focus on profit making or whatever it might be, the thing is just it's definitely not integral, and it becomes unbalanced. And of course, the rules of the four quadrants are this: that anything good and supportive and healthy you do in any of the four quadrants actually helps and raises up and gives strength to the other four quadrants. And on the other hand, anything, that you do negatively in any of the four quadrants affects the other one. So if you are polluting yourself with, several grams of methamphetamines every day, obviously that's going to destroy your physical health. And if you guys have seen people in advanced stages of meth addiction, there's scabs all over. They're losing their teeth. They're virtually insane. And what do you think the interiors like are of a meth addict? Basically, just amphetamine fueled psychosis, insanity, and of course, this is brutal when it comes to the lower left quadrant, or the we space, because there's violence, there's insanity, there's stealing, there's criminality, etc. And, you know, every time we lose a person to this disease and lose their potential as a citizen, as a contributor, as a part of the human family, the whole lower right thing is also hurt, because there's this person obviously not producing anything, giving back to life, but they're taking, and they're drawing off resources for law enforcement and prisons and hospitals that could be used in more, you know, in much more effective and happier ways to do more good than just, you know, fighting off this prevalence of this disease. So, yeah. No, so anybody would like to, any comments or questions or anything you'd like to add at this point? What was that?
I've just unmuted everybody, so anyone's free to ask questions.
Guy, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Maybe Eddie or Victoria would like to ask on that.
Or make a comment, or add to what compare this to your experience and what you see, or wherever it takes you.
We've got Hamlet and Victoria and Eddie all here.
Yeah, I mean, what you were saying with the quadrants, John. it seems like such a simple concept, but I think I was working with the quadrants for 5 or 6 years until I think the real significance of what the quadrants actually mean in a Wilberian context sort of really dawned upon me, that these aren't just, four perspectives, because if one sort of looks at it from these are four perspectives, it seems nearly common sense. But as Wilber points out, these aren't, I mean, they're perspectives as well.
You want to say a little more about them being perspectives, guys?
But these are actually four mentions.
Oh, Guy, we're not hearing you very well. You're breaking up.
How's that? Is that better?
That's fine now, but we didn't hear you past their four perspectives.
Okay, I think I just saw that there was a bit of a connection problem.
And John,
the superficial, the superficial. Yes, I did.
John was hoping you'd tell us more about the four perspectives.
Yeah, okay. I'll add a bit to that. I think from a Wilber context, the perspectives, understanding the quadrants from a perspective point of view, is basically saying that for any Aolan or any organism or being in the world, you can understand the phenomena from four different angles. You know, everything has the exterior, everything has the interior, everything exists as in a way an isolated phenomena, but everything also exists as a communal phenomena. And these four perspectives represent four views that one pretty much, as John was pointing out, needs to include to really understand the phenomena. And obviously what we've been doing in integral recovery is looking at also addiction from these perspectives and see the nature of addiction and also the nature of recovery. And I think that's the program that we pretty much put together, is a program that covers all these bases so people can find healing in all of these areas. But just the other context of the quadrants that I find quite interesting is, isn't always obvious or common sense, is that these four perspectives are more than just perspectives. They're also four zones of your actual being in the world. Normally, when we think of ourselves, we think of ourselves as an isolated individual that obviously has interaction with the world and has interaction with people around you and the environment. But what the quadrants point out is that you actually exist in these four quadrants. So your being, or your, you know, who you are as an individual, isn't merely your interior and your exterior. You are also existing as an extension of your environment, as an extension of your culture. These are more than just perspectives. They are also actually who you are. I mean, literally, you are part of your culture. You are part of your environment. And I think that's very important from a recovery point of view, because they're simply...
Guy, we lost you.
If you are your environment and you are your culture, then the area you need to function as on the area.
Yeah, and thank you, Guy. And also, this is something that is just can be a very practical tool if you're working with yourself, or you're working with a client, or you're working with a family or an organization. And just taking it down to myself, you know, how do I account for, and what practices do I do to cultivate health in all four quadrants? And it could be as simple as, you know, you get up in the morning and, you know, you go get your tea or whatever, and then you sit down to do your meditation. In my case, I usually do an hour in the morning before I get going. And I often have a notebook or something there in case certain ideas or certain things come up that I feel kind of prompted from the kind of this inner intuitive sense that I need to take care of. And then I will, you know, make sure that I, do some exercise. I get to the gym and take care of my physical body, because if I don't, I tend, I don't do very well. I'm an O positive caveman type of blood type. Anyway, there's a whole school about saying that different blood types, you know, prosper better with different diets and everything. But anyway, I've made for lots of physical exercise. I function really well when I push myself to my 10 every day. So because of my disease of depression, that if I ignore my practices and I ignore my physical upper left, I tend to have, I could quite possibly relapse into the depression. And I'm not sure, but I think so, you know. And then, you know, what do I do for my lower left? It's like, what is my engagement with the world? Well, I've moved to Texas right now to help care for my aging parents. That's something that I've done. Have I taken care of my relationships? Are I in communication with my children? Am I cultivating the friendships that are important in my life? Very, very important stuff. That definitely make a different quality, or whether one is going to have a happy life, an authentically happy life, or not so much. And recent, probably in the last 10 years, book by William Glasser, very influential author and psychologist. He wrote Reality Therapy, which is one of kind of the founding principles of the wilderness therapy movement that I was a part of for many years. And basically he says that in a therapy, and this is good for everyone to know, that in a therapeutic relationship, what matters is not whether you're Jungian or Freudian or this year or thatian, but what it seems to be really the determinant of a successful outcome of therapy is if there is a committed, connected relationship between the therapist and the client. So you're really connected in a deep, caring, emotional way. So and wilderness is a very, very good way to facilitate that, because you're out struggling, going up the mountains and cooking your foods together and surviving together in very challenging ways. And if people are doing it correctly, I mean, it could fall apart into chaos, or you could deeply bond as a group. And when we are deeply committed and bonded to other human beings, there's a certain quality of purpose and meaning and moral behavior that emerges from that. Somebody who belongs tends to behave in a moral way. So when you know that you belong to a group, a loving group, and you're connected to that group, you will tend to make correct decisions, like, oh, should I, you know, put this, snort this into my nose, or eat this, or drink this, or stick this in my arm. And that is why in addiction there is a progressive pattern of isolation. So as we mentioned before, you break out of your families, you create new communities of users, but as the disease progresses, the betrayal, the paranoia, the hatred, the crazy acting out tends to destroy that, destroy relationships. So the addict ends up very, very alone and very isolated, very sad, and at the point where just using drugs to kill yourself, it makes a lot of sense at that stage. So,
John, that was this is Hamlet. Can I chime in?
You bet.
That was a very refreshing perspective that you just shared, how these practices not only are aimed at, let's say, reaching a higher state of being or reaching more permanent levels of, you know, happiness or being or whatever, but that they actually are more of a maintenance from keeping one from relapsing into, let's say, in your case, depression, mm-hmm. or addiction or whatever. I also, find that, you know, if I go through 3 or 4 days where I'm just eating like crappy processed foods, I tend to slip back into a very like depressed sort of mental fogginess, haze. I'll sleep in, I'll skip the morning meditation. My workouts aren't as intense. So it's a refreshing take to know that these practices in the four quadrants are also a kind of like a relapse prevention, I would call it, scheme of practices, not just aimed at making one feel better, but sometimes just to keep you at bay from relapsing into old ways of being, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's thank you for teasing that out and making it more clear. So fundamentally, yeah, it's a relapse prevention. And if you do have a life-threatening disease, that's pretty important. You know, and no way in heck do I want to go back to the way I was before. And that keeps us going. And one of the slogans, that the truisms that I, you know, and when I'm saying slogans, I'm not saying, you know, a cliche that doesn't, you know, have any power, but actually a brief bit of encapsulated wisdom, like, you know, in AA, you have one day at a time, and easy does it, and, you know, there's a lot of that stuff that can really be helpful. But in integral recovery, you said that relapse happens not when you ingest a substance, but when you stop practicing. Oh. And I've just seen that across the board. If people stay with the practices, they tend to stay sober. And when they start slipping on it, and they're like, I don't know, you know, getting an attitude or for whatever reason, and then they start going back into the kind of the old trance-like, you know, habitual behaviors, and you know, in the case of addiction, that can be deadly. So you have to be careful. Also, I found that when people do relapse, often a relapse or have a slip, or, you know, I mean, there's, you know, having a glass of wine and going, oh my God, what I did, and there's, you know, going on a bender. Or binge drinking, which is something else, but they tend to get back up on the horse much more quickly, and of course, depending on the client, but generally speaking, when somebody does that I'm working with, it's just okay. Well, you know, hey, to fall on your face is human, right? We all do it in different ways, and so all the work that you've done prior to this is not discounted. Doesn't mean, you know, you know it wasn't valid, and all this stuff is cumulative. So we work, we make mistakes, and we dust ourselves off, and get back on the horse and keep going. And I find when I don't, you know, just totally like get into dissecting, what was the state of mind, a little bit of that, just to know what your triggers are and whatnot. But I don't overly spend enough time on it. I get them back into the practice and get them back moving in the direction that they need to be going.
Yeah.
This is Victoria, and I wanted to comment on what Guy said about this. This is who you are. The four quadrants being who you are, and it's kind of taking me a minute to integrate that. But it seems that for all of us is just a more I guess, deeply integrated way to perceive all of this. As you were talking, John, I was so aware of the beauty of this system and how it does address so much that hasn't been addressed in addiction treatment, that it's been a little bit here, a little bit there in the different quadrants. But somehow when you take it to that inner space of this is who each of us is, it just adds a whole new meaning to a whole new perspective and way of looking at that.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, absolutely. And again, you know, going to the lower right quadrant, which you say is just the out there objective world, well, that also includes nature. You know, and there's, I think in the DSM-5 or 6, whatever it is now, the diagnostic statistical manual that therapists, at least in the United States, use to diagnose mental psychological disorders in order to get insurance money to pay for it, treatment. I think there's a nature deficit disorder that's coming up, but that's been talked about. And I'm not sure if it's included there yet, but the angst, the pathology, the despair when we get too cut off from the natural world. And obviously we can see how this could be pandemic in our culture because, in, for example, in rural America, there's less and less people living out, you know, in the small family farms and whatnot, and more people are going into, you know, the larger cities. And cities can be wonderful, inspiring places too. I have cities that I just adore. But in beyond that, of course, we live in the virtual world now, you know, where we're online, we're in our iPhones, we're, you know, in computers, computer games and stuff like that, and that can have all kinds of problems and become addictive, but also can weaken the connective tissues to us in the universe. There's something very, very important about being out in nature and being connected to other life forms. And it kind of helps us to get away from this strictly human identification, human narcissism, like as if our species was the only one that matters. And, yeah, so that's another thing to remember in the lower right quadrant and helping our clients to have some sort of connection with that. Whether, you know, you're in Moscow, you know, one of the largest cities of the world, at least you walk along the river, you know, or you go to a park, or you have flowers in your house or something to make that connection. It seems to be a deep, profound human need. And one of the ways that I work with that now is, my dog. I take her out every morning. We go out and run around the wilderness when I'm in Utah and here in Texas. We go out on the farm. So I spend a lot of time, like evening and every evening and every morning, I'm out on the land, which is really great because there's a very that liminal time, you know, when the sun's going down, the sun coming up, the very very special. Sacred time, and I think all the kind of different shamanistic cultures and, you know, post-shamanistic cultures have all recognized those as something, you know, very profoundly spiritual in those moments, and I spend a lot of time out there, and it really helps. So does anybody see any image kind of things that could be added to what I'm saying or that you've noticed in your own practice and how you, and I only started with my upper right, you know, exercise and interior work, but then, of course, then there's a relational stuff that we have. Oh, and I wanted to say, I didn't finish with the Glasser quote, but he said that, you know, there's like maybe, you know, 5 to 10 relationships that in our lives that how we cultivate those relationships has a great impact on whether we have a happy life. And, you know, and I'm talking about an authentically deep grounded life. So I don't know if we talk about that enough in integral recovery and certainly not in our culture, how friendships and relationships, marriages, children take time, take effort, being willing to work issues and stick with one another. And reaching out and actually spending time together with friends. Very important stuff. And sometimes I think I've certainly taken a lot of that stuff for granted over my lifetime. And in the last 10 or 15 years, I've tried to make more effort to pay attention to that, because people and these relationships are very, very precious and are very sacred and deeply, you know, deeply resonant ways.
This is Victoria again. I'm also very aware of the new rising up of groups that are focused on the we space,
mm-hmm.
and really exploring what that means, what the potential for a different kind of interpersonal connection. It just seems to be kind of a new thing that's rising up now.
Yeah. Are you referring to Evolutionary Collective, those guys, Victoria?
That's part. It's certainly one piece of it. I've not followed the integral as much recently, but I think there's also a movement there too, isn't there? Unless I'm mistaken. I think Thomas Hubble or Hubler is another one who's focusing mm-hmm. on that.
Yeah.
And it feels sort of like in Spiral Dynamics, it is that movement now to a more collective perspective, away from the focus on the me.
Well, you know, and it's interesting, Victoria, to mention that. If you look at Spiral Dynamics, you're kind of seeing this oscillation between individual and group, individual and group. So you go down to the very, the earliest age, beige, it's just individual survival, right? Like the infant is not too much focused on connecting with brothers and sisters, or, hold me, feed me, change me, nurture me. And very individual at a very primitive level. And you go to purple, which is kind of the magic, tribal thing. It becomes more group collected. It's the tribe. Then you go to red, it's the hero. It's the individual. Then you go to blue, it's the church. It's the sangha. It's the community. It's the believers. However that you go to orange again, it becomes very individualistic. It's individual rights. Listen to the Bill of Rights and the United States. Every individual has rights of blah, 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 for life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. It's individual, honoring the individuality of it. And then, of course, after a while, the individuality of orange can turn into just, ridiculous narcissism after a while in the pathological part of it. And then you have the move to green, which is, hey, let's all be one. Let's all be together. And, in the 60s, people were living on communes, and it was all about oneness and togetherness. And even when you go into the second tier realm, you see in the early phases of integral, or the second tier, yellow, whatever the color is that it's kind of an individual thing. You're kind of waking up to this and understanding the world and your place in it all together. And then as you move into kind of the more mature or latter parts of second tier, it becomes more, you kind of absorb that knowledge and that understanding, and then you begin to move into that collective, but at obviously at a much more mature and deeper level than, back at beige in the beginning. So there's this oscillation between individuality and collective, individuality, collective. And I think the latter stages of kind of the second tier integral, it really becomes this, you begin to understand or stabilize the unitive experiences that we have in deep, in our deep interior practice, and that becomes where you can kind of hold that perspective ongoing, not as a mere intellectual idea, but as a deep embodied feeling of connection with the universe and all beings.
Right.
So yeah, and so there has to be, and of course, if you're going to be integral, there has to be both. There has to be the honoring of the individual and the honoring of the collective. And if you're too much honoring the individual, becomes very narcissistic and, hey, I got mine, screw everybody else. And then if it's too much, it's just the group, becomes some kind of, authoritarian fascist thing. So we have to have kind of a balance where we honor both You know, and when I was in grad school, I was a graduate assistant of Fritjof Capra, author of Tao of Physics, The Turning Point, et cetera. And back then, we were beginning to use some of the metaphors that they were finding from quantum physics, you know, where you look at these little entities, subatomic particles, and you look at them one way and it's a field. It's all, you know, it just goes on to infinity. You look at it another way, it's an individual particle, a wavicle, a little thing, a little event. And so that's kind of, we were going, yeah, that's kind of what it's like spiritually. You know, we are individually amazing and have all these things, but then again, at the same time, we are part of it all, both at the same time, ongoing. Mm-hmm. So, and an interesting perspective too to take in recovery. You know, how do we honor and deal with the individual as well as and heal the individual at the same time, honor and take into account and heal the collective.
And that's another place that this can be so helpful, because I remember going to a conference where, and it was on addiction recovery, where an African-American person was speaking and said that often the AA model did not work, this was a number of years ago, but that the current treatment model didn't work because it was so focused on the individual, and in the African American community, there's so much focus on the community.
Yes.
So I just bring that up as a reinforcement for what you're saying. It has to be all of it.
No, I absolutely agree, and of course you have to take into account different cultural existing norms, and I lived a lot of years in Latin America, and there's a more sense of, you know, families are more together, you know, for better or for worse, they hang, you know, and in the U.S., you know, we just 18 man, we all head out the door, go individual ways. And I remember coming, you know, back from spending years in South America or Mexico or where I was, and then coming back to the United States, and you know, kind of digging some of the vibes of the United States, but at the same time, I feel kind of lonely here. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not as connected. You know, it's not that kind of thing. So, and that has to be, it has to be balanced. And, you know, the balance is not the middle. The balance is where the balance is. And I remember somebody was speaking one time, and they had a writing pin, you know, and they tried to balance it on the finger, and of course right in the middle it wouldn't balance because it was heavier on one end and lighter on the other, so you had to find that point where it was really balanced, and that where that center is will shift, and sometimes you'll need to push more in the area of the collective, and other times you'll need to be pushed more in the area of the individual, and sometimes, you know, it'll be kind of equally. So anyway, that's one of the kind of intuitions, intuitive things that you can understand as we become more intricately informed and cognizant. Well, that was something. Anybody have any closing comments? I got a client in about 2 minutes.
Cross training of the quadrants. That's what I'm going to do.
That's it. That's exactly it. And realize what your strongest, what's your, you know, the most comfortable for you, and realize your deficits, the areas that need to improve, and you know, design the practices to do that.
Yep.
Well, okay. Anything? Thanks, Heidi. Guy, you still there?
Still here.
Okay. Well, cool. And anyway, guys, practice hard, work hard, and let's see if we can do some good together. Okay.
See you guys Friday.
All right.
Thanks very much.
God bless. See you.
Nice lecture. Thank
bye.
You.
Bye.
Yeah. Bye-bye.